This is Free Speech Radio News for September 15th. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up, 10,000 protesters disrupt the World Economic Forum in Melbourne, Australia. Selma, Alabama votes in its first African-American mayor. French sheep farmer José Bové sentenced to 3 months in jail for wrecking a McDonald's. And the first national elections in Yugoslavia since the end of NATO bombing. Will Milosevic survive? More than 10,000 protesters hit the streets of Melbourne, Australia this week to take on the World Economic Forum. The forum, best known for its annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland, brings together many of the world's most powerful business leaders, and their meetings have become a target for critics of the corporate-controlled global economy. This week, protesters prevented hundreds of delegates from entering the meeting and drew a harsh response from the city's police force. But as correspondent Juliet Fox of Melbourne community radio station 3CR reports, there was often little connection between the reality of action in the streets and the reports in the mainstream media.
The 3 days from September the 11th to the 13th saw well over 10,000 people gather around the Crown Casino to blockade and disrupt the forum. Dr. Vandana Shiva was one of just a handful of anti-corporate globalisation activists who actually attended the forum. Protesters parted to allow her access, and inside she took the opportunity to read a statement from those demonstrating outside.
The WEF represents corporate interests, not the interests of the people they employ or displace, or the land and resources they exploit for their financial gain. We are students, mothers, fathers, workers, unemployed, environmentalists, from religious traditions, indigenous people, amongst others. We are blockading the Crown Casino today to use one of the tools that we as community groups and individuals have, civil disobedience.
Meanwhile, on the outside, the days were focused on seeking to block entry and exit to the World Economic Forum delegates. With thousands successfully blocking the many entrances to Crown Casino, the organisers were forced to use helicopter, boat or brute police force to move the delegates.
It's Tuesday, September 12th, and I'm here at the Crown Casino at the World Economic Forum protests. And we've had quite a few thousand people down here this morning, again from 6 a.m. And there's a range of concerns that are represented here. I'm actually standing at Green Block, which is a collaboration of environmental and social justice organisations from around Australia who have come together to peacefully and effectively blockade here at the casino, to highlight what our concerns with the companies inside the World Economic Forum are. This morning, probably about 7:30 a.m., there were something like 500 police in riot gear that launched an attack on protesters, and a number of people were injured. And basically, the police used a disproportionate amount of force against protesters, and that's how the police got 7 buses of delegates in this morning.
Okay, and obviously there's been a lot of media down here. There's been a lot of mainstream media down here. I understand that you were involved in an incident this morning when the riot police were there, when some people were injured. Can you tell me what happened this morning?
Yes, somebody who had been injured was approached by about half a dozen people from the mainstream media, and we asked the media to stand back while we ascertained the extent of her injuries and whether she was okay. And they simply told us that if she didn't answer questions straight away, then we'd lost the story, basically. And when I asked them, well, could you please wait a minute, they all left. One of them did stay and said, if you don't give me a quote, I'll basically just say that the protesters were violent, which is a pretty ironic situation when you've got 500 police in riot gear and a woman sitting there with her hand bleeding, who's obviously just, been on the receiving end of a brute force from the police. So it was a really disgraceful situation from the mainstream media. And, I mean, I guess what can you expect? The people sitting inside the World Economic Forum own all those mainstream media outlets, and we've just got to be grateful that we've got a fantastic independent media network here to record what's really happening at the World Economic Forum, and that is any of the violence has been at the hands of police, and that on the whole, protesters here are maintaining a really effective and peaceful blockade.
The corporate Australian mainstream media maintained a clear focus on violent protesters over the 3 days.
There is so much hype. When I saw the news last night, it wasn't the event I was at. I walked the line at least 10 times yesterday from one end to the other, and I saw like thousands and thousands and thousands of people doing really spirited, really strong non-violent action, and it really had a good atmosphere to it.
Inside the forum, community media representatives were able to observe the reaction of the forum members to the protests outside.
And my worry, I think, and that's come out today, has been that their response to these questions raised, you know, or, you know, obviously the big impact being made by the blockade, is that they'll just have to sell their message more effectively. Their response seems to be, well, we obviously have been missing the mark as far as advertising and promoting ourselves goes, and we'll have to do that more effectively in the future. Not, this is a serious problem, we need to sort of fundamentally change the way we do things.
The successful demonstrations at the World Economic Forum Summit in Melbourne were not without their costs. Many people were hospitalised, one of whom was run over by an unmarked police car. Organisers and members of the legal community are now calling for an inquiry into excessive police violence, and it looks likely that legal action will follow. As for the struggle against corporate globalisation, it now turns its attention to Prague, where the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank will meet on September 26th, or S26. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Juliet Fox in Melbourne, Australia.
French sheep farmer José Bovet has been sentenced to 3 months in jail for his role in the 1999 destruction of a McDonald's restaurant in the French town of Millau. Bovet, one of the best-known figures in the anti-globalization movement, and eight other activists used farm implements to do serious damage to the McDonald's in what they say was a symbolic protest against U.S. tariffs on European food exports and bad food. None of Bovet's co-defendants were sentenced to any jail time, and Bovet's lawyers say they will appeal the unexpectedly stiff sentence. Alun Griffith has this report from the Independent Media Center in Marseille.
12th of August 1999. In Millau, a small forgotten town in the middle of France, 300 members of the Confédération Paysanne, a militant French farmers' union, symbolically and in broad daylight, take elements of a McDonald's restaurant being built in the town. Against U.S. import taxes levied on Roquefort cheese, which threaten their livelihood. These taxes have still not been withdrawn. September 1999, José Bové, spokesperson for the Confédération Paysanne, is arrested along with 10 of his colleagues. Bové refuses to stand bail and spends 3 weeks behind bars. 30th of June, the year 2000, the 10 arrested men stand trial in Millau in an atmosphere of celebration and fête. Calling on expert witnesses from around the world, including Dr. Vandana Shiva, Laurie Wallach or Susan George, the Confédération Paysanne managed to shift the emphasis of the proceedings and put globalisation itself in the dock. The French state prosecutor asked for a one-month prison sentence for José Bové, seen as the main leader of the movement. 13th of September, year 2000, Millau, 2:30 p.m, the verdict. In front of a small crowd of supporters chanting, "We are all José Bové's," the verdict is announced. To the complete astonishment, Bové is condemned to a three-month prison sentence, whereas the others escape with small fines. In the words of the court judgment, this prison sentence is to make Bové see sense. But political sense or sense of occasion is not something lacking chez Bové. A recent opinion survey revealed that 16% of the French population would vote for Bové if he stood for president in France in 2002. It's not surprising, then, that his counterattack calls on the French president, the government, and the mainstream political parties to listen to the growing citizens' anti-globalisation movement.
Let's be clear, over the next elections, and especially the presidentials in 2002, these citizens and their movements will have to be listened to by the candidates. We'll have to take account of their demands for a clear position in respect of multinational corporations, notably the World Trade Organization, which is destroying the fundamental rights of our European populations and individuals.
So an unrepentant Bové has thrown down the gauntlet to the French state, and the stage is set for a Millau B when the appeal is heard in Montpellier next year. This is Alan Griffiths reporting for the French Independent Media Centre.
This week, Russian environmental whistleblower Alexander Nikitin was put on trial on charges of treason for the second time. In his first trial, which dragged on for 3 years, Nikitin was acquitted by Russia's Supreme Court. But now it wants him tried again, saying the prosecution's illegal conduct rendered the first trial invalid. The new trial extends the ordeal, which began in 1996, when Nikitin made world headlines by exposing what he called Chernobyl in slow motion, the Russian Navy's dumping of decommissioned submarines in the Barents Sea. The Federal Security Bureau, the post-Soviet equivalent of the KGB, said he'd revealed military secrets, even though Nikitin's statements were based entirely on previously published reports. Natural resource policy is a core issue for Russia's political elite, and Nikitin's case has focused international attention on the targeting of independent environmentalists in Russia. Rory Cox is communications director for Pacific Environment, a U.S. group with close ties to Russian environmentalists. I asked him whether the Nikitin case reflected a broader pattern of harassment of environmentalists in Russia.
Environmentalists that actually do work regarding the military waste, you know, or waste that came from military operations, seem to be getting the brunt of actions against environmentalists. However, increasingly, other environmental groups are also getting cracked down on. And the FSB, which is the sort of security apparatus, the successor to the KGB, last March went on a sort of a campaign of cracking down on several environmental organizations that work on other issues that aren't necessarily militarily related. Greenpeace's office in Moscow was shut down for about a day under the guise of a tax audit or an internal audit of their books or something like that. But it was a sort of an excuse to kind of, you know, go through all their records. However, one colleague organization of ours in southern Siberia in a region called Altai had their office, they were actually evicted from their office because they had an arrangement with a university which, you know, is by way of the government. Well, the government said, well, you can't, you know, you're doing these activities, and in particular, campaigning against an oil pipeline that will run from Siberia to China. we're not happy with these. You know, they found some other irregularity as an excuse to kick him out of the office, but mm-hmm. they were able to exist in that office for years without any other problems. You know, as soon as they start to really pose a threat to something like a big oil pipeline, then it gets to be something like getting evicted will happen.
Your group and others have objected to World Bank support for mining and forestry projects.
Right.
What's disturbing about that support to you and what's going ahead now?
What's disturbing is that the World Bank is going forward with, I believe, $200 million in loans and loan guarantees into the forestry and coal sectors. What's disturbing about that is last May, the Russian government Putin single-handedly abolished the Committee on Ecology, which is sort of the equivalent of our own Environmental Protection Agency. And they have been in the process of folding their responsibilities under the Ministry of Natural Resources. The Ministry of Natural Resources leases and is responsible for the for minerals and oil and gas exploration and exploitation. So it's, you know, sort of putting the fox in charge of the hen house. The World Bank could have sent a message, you know, a stronger message by withholding these loans. We really need to have an independent body over there. 87% of the Russian people have condemned Putin's action, which is, you know, kind of extraordinary. And, you know, the World Bank claims to be a more transparent, more democratic institution than it used to be, but it's still, you know, in spite of the public outrage in Russia against Putin's action, they're still, you know, going ahead with these loans. They're saying it's with some conditionalities, that there really will be, you know, strong monitoring of these projects. But, you know, we don't know how that can happen without an independent agency in place.
The picture we get in the U.S. press about Russia, to the extent that we get much coverage, mm-hmm. is that there's a domestic oligarchy that, working along with the government, seems to be doing a lot of this looting of natural resources that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What's the role, though, of international institutions like the World Bank and also multinational corporations in what's going on in Russia? I think we get less of that.
Well, the multinationals are, in some sectors, have had, in the forestry sector, the multinationals haven't had a lot of success in Russia because a lot of the forests are inaccessible and there's not a great infrastructure for forestry. However, the mineral industries and the oil and gas industries have been much more successful at setting up operations around there. Probably the biggest investment in the Russian Far East, which is where we do a lot of our work, is around Sakhalin Island, which is an island just north of Japan. And I believe it's about the size of California. Sakhalin Island has rich fisheries around it, but companies like Exxon and several other Shell and several other oil multinationals are doing some offshore drilling.
The multinationals, international institutions, are they actually playing a role in forming Russian environmental policy, or are they just the beneficiaries of it?
I think some of both. I think all of these companies couldn't do any of this without some aid from their domestic government. So if a Canadian gold mining company wants to go mine there, they usually get some sort of form of corporate welfare from their export credit agency. Same for Exxon when they go drill in and around Sakhalin. So they are beneficiaries of Russia, not only Russian policy but also our policy towards Russia.
Roy Cox, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Selma, Alabama, this week elected its first African American mayor in history, removing from office Joe Smitherman, who'd been the city's mayor for 33 of the last 35 years. Smitherman came to power on a pro-segregation platform, and in 1965, he presided over the vicious attacks on civil rights marchers who came to the city led by Martin Luther King Jr. The campaign which ended Smitherman's reign was marked by an unprecedented organizing effort which brought in activists from across the country. But there was also backlash, including death threats and the firebombing of a car owned by an anti-Smitherman activist. From Selma, Dave Lippman reports on the impact of the historic election.
Downtown Selma, Alabama was the scene of ecstatic celebrations on Tuesday night as James Perkins Jr. was elected the first African-American mayor of the city that gave birth to the Voting Rights Act. In the town made famous by the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where police beat and gassed civil rights marchers on Bloody Sunday in March 1965, black Selmians mounted a determined drive to oust Joe T. Smitherman, the man who was mayor then and has remained in power for the last 35 years. Perkins won 57% of the tally in a runoff election that drew a record turnout of 11,000 voters. The celebrants' enthusiasm overflowed for hours on the city's streets. In addition to the Perkins campaign organization, an informal aggregation of black citizens mounted a Joe Gotta Go campaign. Local activists called for national assistance. The NAACP, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and students from around the South came to help get out the vote.
What we fought for in the 60s, the right to vote, has now paid off in the year 2000. It's going to take a while for white Selma to realize that it's not a bad thing for a black person to be mayor, because it's about justice for all people, which it has been all along.
The days leading up to the vote saw car caravans and street corner brigades shouting, "Honk if Joe gotta go," and "Everybody, everybody get your vote on." Tension built through a series of allegations of absentee ballot fraud and Smitherman comments such as, "Blacks don't have the concept of working within budgets." Even after the vote, Smitherman's nephew Jack kept up the drumbeat, saying, "It's going to be a monkey town." Others are more optimistic. Reverend Randall Osborne of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
It's not just the new mayor for Selma, it's a new mayor for America. We think in the civil rights movement and the human rights movement that as Selma goes, so goes the nation. President King of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is literally in Los Angeles, and as I spoke with him a few minutes ago, he is addressing a business group that he is going to be challenging to look at Selma as a new place in the South to bring industry.
And finally, from one of the youth organizers.
It's a great way to start off the 21st century. We are so excited to feel hope in this city again.
And are these people going to drive up and down and honk all night?
All night long. We're going to
party for the next year celebrating Joe leaving.
And to what do you attribute this victory?
I just attribute to smart planning. It was very organized, and we all pulled together to work to take Joe, make him go home.
And what do you think is holds for Selma in the next year?
More jobs, prosperity for African Americans, hope more than anything.
For Free Speech Radio, this is Dave Lippman in Selma, Alabama.
In Yugoslavia, there's a little over a week to go before voters head to the polls in the first nationwide elections since NATO's bombing ended just over a year ago. There's a lot at stake in these elections, most notably the presidency. President Slobodan Milosevic is facing a strong challenge from opposition candidate Vojislav Kostunica. The latest polls show Kostunica leading Milosevic by a 7% margin. More than 4 million of the nearly 8 million eligible voters are expected to cast their ballots. From the Yugoslav capital, Belgrade, Jeremy Scahill files this report.
For over a month, the state-run media in Serbia have flooded the airwaves of radio and television with political campaign ads supporting Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. These ads hammer away on the theme that Milosevic's opponents are NATO servants who get their orders directly from Washington. This ad begins by showing opposition demonstrations against the government in the 1990s. Protesters are shown destroying the Yugoslav flag, and the voiceover says, "First, they destroyed ours." It then cuts to footage of demonstrators waving British and American flags, and the voiceover says, "Then they waved foreign ones." Cut to video of the NATO bombing, and the ad says, "Foreign flags bring foreign warplanes." Another ad shows leading opposition politicians having their pictures taken with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, and then fades to open hands receiving U.S. dollars. These campaign ads are sponsored by the Yugoslav United Left, one of the parties in Milosevic's governing coalition. The head of YUL is Milosevic's wife, Mira Markovic, herself a candidate for federal parliament. She is on state TV almost every night, attacking the opposition movement and invoking images from NATO's 78 days of bombing.
They're only interested in one change, that one change they want to carry out, and that one change they haven't been able to carry out for 10 full years, and that is to establish a puppet government in Belgrade. When the order comes from Brussels or Washington to the headquarters of opposition parties around Serbia, ask for changes. In fact, they only mean one, that's the replacement of the existing government with their own government. These are elections where a choice will be made between the position of a free country and developing society on the one hand and a firing range and a waste dump for the NATO alliance on the other.
The Democratic Opposition of Serbia, or DOS, denies charges that it takes NATO money and gets its orders from Washington. The coalition of 18 political parties has been aggressively campaigning throughout Serbia. The presidential candidate of the DOS is Vojislav Kostunica, a well-known Belgrade constitutional lawyer. DOS officials say the coalition chose Kostunica because of his strong nationalist leanings and his anti-NATO credentials.
He is someone who can hardly be called NATO spy.
University of Belgrade historian Dušan Batakovic is one of Kostunica's advisors.
They cannot attack him because he was one of those who was firmly against NATO bombing during the Kosovo War, and he was condemning NATO policy as illegal and anti-humanitarian. On the other hand, he was all the time condemning Milosevic and telling to the people that Milosevic is a part of the problem, actually the largest part of the problem we have with the rest of the world. Therefore, he is one of those few who some way has offered a useful synthesis of being anti-Milosevic and being a strong and devoted Serb at the same time.
Slobodan Slobodan Milosevic himself has kept a low profile over the past few weeks, opting instead for his wife to hit the campaign trail. He did make a rare public appearance earlier this week in the town of Kusiak at a ceremony to open a new hydroelectric power plant just across the Danube River from Romania. Before a crowd of more than 10,000 people, he launched his re-election campaign, speaking of what he calls the reconstruction efforts of the country in the 16 months since NATO's bombing ended. He painted himself as a pan-Balkanist, calling for greater regional unity, and he invoked themes from the era of longtime communist leader Josip Broz Tito, an era that saw Yugoslavia at the forefront of the non-aligned movement.
Although dedicated to reconstruction and development, its current problems and its future, Yugoslavia wants to sustain a lively and constructive relationship with the whole world. That lively and constructive relationship means the consciousness of the need to connect all freedom-loving peoples and sovereign countries, all the progressive parties and individuals, progressive movements and intellectuals, with the aim to protect themselves and the world from the violence that became global. That violence made the whole Balkan regions its target, believing they wouldn't need a lot of time or energy for its subjugation and conquest. Creators of that concept grounded their estimation about the Balkan Peninsula on their weak knowledge of history.
Milosevic, for the most part, has stayed away from directly attacking his opponents, leaving that to other officials within his coalition. With just over a week to go before the elections, Belgrade is a maze of political billboards. Milosevic's ruling coalition have huge signs with phrases like "For Yugoslavia," "Sloba Yes," and "The People Choose, Not NATO." The Democratic Opposition of Serbia is running ads with Kostunica's face on billboards that ask, "Who has always been able to look you in the eyes?" as well as ones with the phrase, "Our commitment, no sanctions, and better wages." Though the opposition says it is not working directly with the U.S., its members have met regularly with many of the key players in the NATO bombing, including U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Richard Holbrooke. Though they admit they are receiving moral support from the U.S., they deny receiving any direct funding. Nonetheless, the rhetoric of the DOS advocates a Western-style democracy modeled after the very countries that bombed Yugoslavia.
The platform of the Democratic Opposition of Serbia is pretty simple.
Milan Stoprotic is the DOS candidate for mayor of Belgrade and the federal parliament.
We want fundamental changes in this country inside and outside. We want Serbia to become part of Europe and the Western world, and at the same time we want to develop it inside as a truly democratic environment based on free market economy, which we believe is the only way for this people to see a better life in the future.
The Democratic Opposition of Serbia claims it is the clear front-runner in these elections. They point to polls showing Kostunica capturing as much as 60% of the vote. But other analysts say that even if there is no voter fraud, it would still be a tight race. But in Yugoslavia, that's a very big if. One thing, though, is for sure. There is a very weary public here in Serbia. People have suffered enormously over the last decade, from four wars, NATO bombing, economic sanctions, and domestic anti-democratic rule. Wages continue their steady decline while long lines for vegetable oil and sugar mark the streets of Serbian cities. Perhaps the real question to be answered by these elections is who people hold most responsible for their present condition. Do people believe Milosevic, under indictment from the International Criminal Tribunal and isolation from the international community, when he speaks of rebuilding the country? Or do they think they'll get a better deal from an opposition advocating a political system modeled after the very countries that bombed Yugoslavia just over a year ago? Some here say that either way, the people will be the losers. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. For more information on the strike, check out our website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. I'm Matt Martin. Please tune in again next week.